You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, learn about Welcome Corps, a program the White House rolled out last month that lets private citizens sponsor refugees to resettle in their communities. Now, the Food and Drug Administration is proposing new limits to the amount of lead in baby food. A draft proposal sets limits at 10 parts per billion in fruit, meat, and most vegetable products, 20 parts per billion for cereal and root vegetable products. The FDA points toward the particular vulnerability of babies and infants to the effects of lead exposure. Dr. Dennis Kostakis is the Department Chair of Pediatrics and a neonatologist at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse. He's also an Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. Dr. Kostakis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me for this important, what I think is an important topic.
And could you talk about why this is so important, lead exposure, especially for babies and infants?
Well, first of all, when you think about lead, you know, with the smelting of silver, you know, 4,000 years ago, one of the byproducts was lead. For a considerable amount of time, even in this century, you know, we had lead-based paints, which you can still find sometimes in older homes. We had lead in gasoline, which, you know, sort of disappears in the 80s and 90s in the U.S., and the good news is blood levels in general for lead, which we never believe has a safe level, have been falling in the United States. I mean, we watch the levels, they are decreasing. And they've also been decreasing in places like France. So human beings have gotten smart to say, you know, we don't really need lead in gasoline. We don't really need lead paint. So how do you get lead in your body? Well, you eat it, or you breathe it, or you put it on your skin. Most of the absorption is going to be inhale it or eat it. Now, you mentioned, why are children more vulnerable to lead? Children tend to, if I were to eat some lead, I might absorb 1 or 2% of it, but a child will absorb about 50% of that. So if you think about children, where do they begin? They begin in utero as a fetus. And of course, lead exposure there is going to be through the mother. So I think prenatal care is important because one of the ways to mitigate lead is to have a good iron status. So in prenatal care, you know, hemoglobin, hematocrit is checked. Prenatal vitamins, very typically with iron, is given. That helps mitigate any lead. And lead will be passed through the placenta. Once a baby's born, you know, you might ask, well, what is the most normal healthy diet for a baby? Well, the answer is breast milk. And, you know, if you ask yourself, well, how would lead get in the breast milk? Well, if all of us living in the world get some lead in our water, which we do, and you can measure lead to parts per trillion. And certainly with water, just like they want to do with baby food, with water, we like to keep that water, parts per billion on the 15 level, if you will. But, you know, people who are breastfeeding, they eat, they drink water. So society also got smarter a ways back of saying, well, let's not use lead solder when we do piping. So that's also tremendously helped. And so if you're a breastfeeding woman, maybe you wouldn't want to be around a house that's being renovated, you know, especially if that house is prior to 1978, that would kick up some lead or lead dust. You always want to know what's being put in your body, because you see, the reason lead gets into things like baby food is some of the baby foods are made, whether they're cereals or whether they're from fruit, once it's in the soil, lead is in the soil, of course, it's going to get into the plants and the fruits. So maybe one key would be for women who are pregnant or even after the child is born, is having a diverse diet. You want to put things in your body that you know what they are. So for example, take marijuana, for example. Marijuana does have lead in it. So, you know, that's not going to be something the FDA is going to necessarily check out for you. So you want to be clever about that. I give you a funny story. My one of our a teapot sort of cracked a few weeks ago in my house. We'd had the teapot, a nice, very nice teapot that we bought many, many years ago, and it had to be tossed out. So, looking around for another teapot in the house, there was one that looked almost antique. We were looking at it just for show, and I boiled some tea, and then I realized, wait a minute, I don't know anything about this teapot. Could this be a teapot that, has lead in the ceramic? So the other thing you want to be careful of is not only the food, and what you're putting in your body, but when you think about it, if you are living in Wisconsin, your water's probably being monitored. You can get water tested, but that also means that if you're using ceramics or pottery, where are they from? How old are they? Are they lead based?
I want to key in because we don't have a ton of time, Dr. Kostakis. I want to key in on the baby foods now. We think of the jar of the strange sweet potatoes or that box of the rice or wheat cereal. What do you make of these new FDA draft guidelines on those?
Oh, I would not be too overly alarmed as a parent. I'd be looking and saying to myself, they're looking out for me. But even the amounts of lead that we're talking about in baby food will not hurt the baby. It's just that lead, I want you to think of it as a neurotoxin. There's never a safe level. So you want to, a society, which has been doing over the last 30, 40 years in the United States and France and other places, we keep doing things that diminishes the amount of lead in the soil, and we keep getting there's five or six different ways to test for lead, and we've got systems now that can even detect lead to parts per trillion. So, for example, with this latest FDA saying, okay, 20 for the cereals, and by the way, one of the ways a mother could decrease lead to her baby is not just get rice cereal, but get some cereals that have quinoa or other grains. Make it a very diverse diet. But basically, if we'd have gone back 20 years and you said to me, how much lead are we tolerating in the diet and what are we looking at? It would have been 100 times more easily. So we are actually, this is a really a call, a higher standard. So I would tell, give your children, or if you're pregnant, get a variety of foods in. Read the food labels. Make sure you're not getting food sources always from the same place. Don't stick with rice cereal. You can use cereals that are based on oat, barley, quinoa, I mentioned, bulgur, multi-grain infant cereals. Maybe that's the take home. That's what you should be giving your baby to mitigate this. If you're concerned about your water, get it tested. If you breastfeed the baby, you will reduce exposure to all the toxic metals, whether it's cadmium or lead. Baby food is one thing, snacks is another. When children want to learn how to teethe, you're better off with a teething ring or even a little frozen banana. Crackers and teething biscuits, they're going to have more lead. You know this, and I know this. The less we eat processed foods, the healthier. So I think that I would not be up for alarm. I would keep in mind that the babies, 20, 30 years ago, were getting more lead. They're getting less now, but we can measure it better. And it looks like the FDA is putting a higher standard, where they're going to watch the manufacturers, and I think that the amounts of lead we're talking about in baby food, should not hurt the baby. But remember, lead, when it gets into a human, it can go into soft tissue, it can go into bone, it could go into blood and then come out in 30 days. But we also store some lead too. So, we do want to decrease how much lead we're putting into our bodies.
Dr. Kostakis, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Dennis Kostakis, Department Chair for Pediatrics and a neonatologist at Mayo Clinic Health System in La Crosse, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at Mayo Clinic Alex School of Medicine. He joined us for a look at FDA's draft guidelines on lead levels in baby food. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tribute to a Wisconsin astronaut who tragically passed away 20 years ago today in the space shuttle Columbia disaster.
So many people dream of going to outer space, of becoming an astronaut. Laurel Clark, she made that a reality. As writer Dean Robbins tells us, the Wisconsinite strived for greatness her entire life.
Astronaut Laurel Clark's life ended abruptly on February 1, 2003, when the space shuttle Columbia exploded near the end of its mission. She was only 41, with a husband and an 8-year-old son. It's one of the saddest stories in NASA history, and yet, whenever I think about Clark, I don't focus on her tragedy. I focus on her smile.
3, 2, 1. We have booster ignition and liftoff of Space Shuttle Columbia with a...
You see it in photographs from the mission, as Clark poses with her 6 crewmates or floats through the cabin in her orange spacesuit. For someone who'd only recently envisioned herself in space, the Columbia experience was a dream come true.
Mission Specialist Laurel Clark, Payload Commander Mike Anderson, and Payload Specialist Ilan Ramon seated down on the middeck.
Back on Earth, Clark described herself as a boring straight-A student at Racine's Horlick High School. She earned both a bachelor's degree in zoology and a medical degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she blossomed intellectually. After college, Clark's life was anything but boring. She joined the Navy, served as an undersea medical officer, and became a flight surgeon. After marrying fellow Navy officer Jonathan Clark, she threw herself into parachuting, rock climbing, and scuba diving. Always on the lookout for new challenges, she hatched the idea of becoming an astronaut in her 30s. The space program turned her down on the first try and accepted her on the second, while she was pregnant. Family and friends recognized Clark's toughness. They knew she would follow her own path, no matter the risk, and that she would enjoy herself in the process. Days before Columbia's liftoff, she had this to say on Milwaukee's WISN-TV.
This mission is just extremely exciting, and I still feel very fortunate to be assigned to this mission. I'm excited to be a test subject because I think that's how we get answers, is by studying people. And as a physician, I understand how important it is to collect data on people.
In space, Clark conducted experiments on moths and roses and played Running to the Light by one of her favorite bands, Runrig. Nearly 200 miles above the Earth, she also maintained her ties to Wisconsin. Two of her in-flight experiments originated at the UW. Her gear included a UW Medical School medallion and a teddy bear with UW-Madison and zoology embroidered on its jacket. For 15 days, 22 hours and 20 minutes, Clark reveled in the wonders of spaceflight. In an email to the folks back home, she described her view from the porthole. Lightning spreading over the Pacific. The aurora australis lighting up the entire visible horizon with the city glow of Australia below. The crescent moon setting over the limb of the Earth. The vast plains of Africa and the dunes on Cape Horn. Clark was especially happy to get a glimpse of the Wind Point Peninsula jutting into Lake Michigan near her childhood home in Racine. Mere minutes before Columbia disintegrated due to a damaged wing, Clark was still in high spirits. The astronauts, unaware of the malfunction, joked around as she filmed them with a digital camera. After encouraging a crewmate to wave, Laurel Clark turned the camera on herself to provide one last image for posterity. It was a smile.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that story on Wisconsin astronaut Laurel Clark. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowland Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we learn about a new program that recruits U.S. citizens to sponsor refugees resettling here in the U.S. That's next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The White House launched a new program last month that allows regular citizens to sponsor refugees from around the world. Welcome Corps is intended to make the refugee resettlement process easier and more welcoming. Anyone who can get together a group of at least 5 people and raise some money can participate. Anya McMurray is President and Chief Operating Officer of Welcome.us. Anya, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Big picture, what is the goal of getting regular U.S. folks together to help sponsor refugees?
Well, I think it's a couple of different things. One, it's to expand our capacity to welcome here in America. And we know it's one thing we're actually quite good at. And so by bringing everyday Americans into that process, we're opening up a system that creates more room for them to do just that. And also, we know that it will have better outcomes for the people who we are welcoming. We will be better able to get them settled, get them set up in their new communities, get their kids enrolled in school, and ultimately put them on solid ground to flourish in our new communities.
What's the first step if somebody's thinking, yeah, I've got some friends or community members or whatever, we could do this thing?
Yeah, well, it starts with a simple trip to a website, welcomecore.org. There's a step-by-step process that you'll find some background information on what you can expect about this life-changing opportunity. And as you said at the beginning, it's finding a group of friends, maybe folks in your neighborhood or members of your church or synagogue, book club. Lots of different ways that you can do this. You have to raise a little bit of money, about $2,000, just over $2,000 per newcomer that you support. And then there's an application process. And we've got systems in place to help you along the process every step of the way.
And the refugees themselves, can you talk a little bit about what they are going through and what kind of screening procedures they go through before they can participate in this?
Sure. These are folks who are a part of what's called the U.S. refugee admissions process. They have been thoroughly vetted. They've been identified by the United Nations, by UNHCR. They've been thoroughly vetted by UNHCR as well as several different component parts of the United States government. They have been deemed to be people in need of refuge, and they have had health clearings as well. So these folks are in the pipeline of individuals who've been determined to be safe, who have real need, and who Americans can provide an opportunity to start a new life here.
All right, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here now. We've got our group of five or more people. A refugee is coming. The sponsors have to have a welcome plan to get ready. What goes into that?
Sure. The welcome plan includes things like, where do you think this person will be able to find housing? Do you have a lead on an apartment? Maybe there's a landlord you know that would help reduce the rent. Where would their child go to school? How would you get them signed up for some of the benefits that they'll be eligible for? It's a step-by-step process that makes sure that you've wrapped your mind around the things that you'll need to do to make this a successful transition for this family. But it's also not overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It's really done in a way that breaks it down into bite-sized pieces. And I think that the thing that we try to remind folks is, all we're asking is for you to be the tour guide to your community, help them navigate systems that most of you know really well already. And to the extent you don't, there's a helping hand just around the corner to help you solve any problems you come up against.
Yeah, this, I think that's a really big point. There is a serious commitment here, but it's not, make a bed in the spare room and this person's going to live with you for a year. There's a serious commitment, but it doesn't sound necessarily overwhelming.
That's right. It is. I think that's right. It's a serious commitment because you are offering really a pathway to a new life for someone. Those folks come with a lot of experiences. Many of them have been through some traumatic situations and are in need of a new opportunity. But what's great about this program is that it really provides a lot of the support systems that you'll need to make the most of it and to provide that really once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And one thing I'll say is what we hear over and over again from Americans who've been doing this is it changes their life every bit as much as it changes the newcomer they're welcoming. It's really a transformative experience.
Now, this Welcome Core program itself is pretty new. What kind of response are you getting so far?
Well, the response has been overwhelming. It launched just a couple weeks ago, and we've had over 20,000 Americans sign up already who are eager to get started.
I know refugee admission numbers have gone down since the modern program started over the last 30 years. Are there enough refugees in need waiting and eligible for all these people to help them on board?
That's a great question. And the answer is yes. Unfortunately, one of the things that we know is true in this world is that people will always need a safe place to go. And America has such an amazing tradition of being that place for so many families for generations and generations. And what we are just tremendously, tremendously excited about with this program is the opportunity to invite more Americans into that experience of helping refugees land on their feet.
Anya, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Anya McMurray, President and Chief Operating Officer of Welcome.us. She talked to us about Welcome Core, the new program that allows regular citizens to sponsor refugee resettlement in their communities. You can find more information if you think you might be interested. Just look for that website, Welcome.us. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, many Americans don't feel engaged at their workplaces, according to a recent Gallup survey. We'll find out what might be driving that and what it means for our personal lives and for the jobs we do. If you feel particularly disengaged or particularly connected to your work, love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. Plus, what are you made of? We'll get a super up-close answer with a look at the atoms and molecules in the human body and their origins, some of them in the stars. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, what's the best way to study for an exam or make sure we remember the things we learn? We'll find out what neuroscience tells us and get some advice for students and for the rest of us. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, take a journey through the worlds of science fiction and fantasy and the world of pop culture that's grown up around them. First, think back to the last time you had a big test or exam to study for, whether it was years ago in high school or college or just last semester. How'd you get ready? Flashcards, practice tests, rereading your notes from class, maybe a little bit of everything. Our next guest says if we want to know what really works, we can look to psychology and how our brains actually retain information. He's looking mainly at school, but there are lessons here for learning at all levels, for work, fun, and beyond. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How did you study during your time in school? Did you take thorough notes? What did that look like? Did you pull the infamous all-nighter to get ready for the big exam? What worked for you? What didn't seem to work? If you're a student right now, how do you study? Do you study? Teachers out there, how do you encourage your students to study and prepare? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Regan Gurung is professor of psychology and director of the General Psychology Program at Oregon State University. He's director there of the Center for Teaching and Learning. And he's co-author, along with John Dunlowski, of the new book, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. He's a former UW Green Bay professor. Regan, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be back, Rob.
Well, one thing that I learned from your book is I might have assumed that, you know, I'm either good at studying or I'm bad at studying, and there's not much I can do about it. The good news of your book, I think, is we can get better at it.
And that is, I think, a great place to start, because far too often, I think people have mindsets that go, I can do this, I can't do that. And I think most of us have probably heard now, whether it's math or something complex, instead of saying, I can't do that, or I'm not good at it, a good way to go is saying, I'm not good at it yet. And I think that's exactly what we set out to do in this book, is to say, look, even if you haven't had success before, here are some really clear-cut things you can do that can make you better at it. And it just takes some practice.
You start with some myth-busting and public myth number one, I think, the idea of learning styles. So we each have our own learning style, and we need to be taught and learn in a particular way. And this, a lot of people, I've thought this in my life. A lot of people that are listening right now, I'm sure, believe this, Regan. What does the research show?
So here's the big deal. I think I want to make clear the distinction between preferences mm-hmm. and matching a teacher and student's learning styles. We all have preferences. We all have preferences for how we like to do things and learn things. But what the research looked at is it really important for the way a teacher teaches to match the preferred learning style of a student? And a very large study looked at all the research that was available and came to the conclusion that matching teaching style and learning style is not important. And in fact, we tend to learn better if we are exposed to different styles. So if you are somebody who goes, oh, I am a insert learning style here. Let's say I am a visual learner, but this person uses a non-visual style, therefore I can't learn. Well, nope, the research shows that's just not the case. So don't use that anymore. That learning style myth has been busted for some time now, but like you said, it's got some staying power. It's still out there. And every year I see the memes out there about learning styles. And I think we've got to remember, move on. You don't have to match learning styles.
That said, there are some things we need to understand about ourselves. And here's one that really hit me. You talk about the idea of a feeling of knowledge. Like, and maybe at some point in everybody's school career, they had the thing like, hey, I got this. I'm ready to nail it. And then you don't nail it. You didn't know as much as you think you do. This is really important. How do we evaluate our feeling of knowledge of the upcoming test, say, versus where we really are?
Right. I think one big thing for us all to remember is that we are very good at deceiving ourselves. We are very good at deceiving ourselves, especially to make us feel better. And our cognitive processes aren't always a direct reflection of reality. So when we talk about the feeling of knowing or the feeling of knowledge, very often it really comes to play when we ask ourselves, do I know this or do I need to do more work on it? And very often we may be overly confident and think we know something when that's not really the case. And let me give you a really specific, I want to share something really specific where that really helps out here. Mm-hmm. This happens very often when we have what we are trying to study or what we want to know in front of us. So imagine studying with a textbook or, if you are somebody using flashcards, remember imagine having a whole bunch of flashcards in front of you. I don't know if you watched somebody use flashcards, Rob, recently, but if you take a look at somebody using flashcards, they will do the classic flip of the card, right? They look at the term on front of the card and then say, oh, do I know this? And then do a quick flip of the card to look at the answer and go, oh yeah, I know it. Well, that's exactly one of those very practical things you can avoid doing to make sure that your feeling of knowledge or feeling of knowing isn't skewed. Because if you have what you're trying to study in front of you, that artificially inflates your feeling of knowing. You think you know it more than you really do because you're not factoring in the fact that there it is, you can see it. And whether that's a flashcard that you've just flipped or your textbook sitting there inflates the feeling of knowledge. You spend less time when you really should be spending more.
Talking to Regan Gurung about his new book. He's co-author, Study Like a Champ, The Psychology-Based Guide to Grade A Study Habits. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. If there's something that's worked for you studying at high school or college or learning to pass a professional exam, something on the job, something that worked for you, something that didn't work for you. If you're doing it right now, maybe you need some advice. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Regan, you looked at research that's out there that compared a lot of different things that can be, many of which can be helpful. What stood out to you as the number one or two things that really pay off for study styles and methods?
Yeah, let's, you know, jumping straight to the punchline, as it were. If you have time, your time studying is best spent testing yourself on the material. That's the number one finding across cognitive science, is that repeat testing or repeat practice, you testing yourself is one of the best ways that you can prepare yourself to learn. And this is in contrast to spending time rereading the material, you know, even studying highlighted material or even flashcards. I mean, flashcards are useful. Studying key terms are useful, but not by themselves. The number one thing you can do is test yourself. The second best thing you can do, and I'll give you the top two, right? Because these are the two that are head and shoulders over everything else. Repeatedly testing yourself and spacing out your studying. And I think in the intro, you mentioned cramming. What cramming does is the complete opposite of spacing, right? Cramming is cramming it all into the night before the exam. The flip side, spacing it out, that's what's really good for you. And I love the way my co-author John likes to talk about it. He says, if repeatedly testing yourself and spacing it out were to date, they would lead to the really best way to do it, which is test yourself repeatedly, but spread out over time. And that's what's really going to get stuff from your working memory into your long-term memory, and you're going to be able to hang on to it much longer.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Rebecca is with us in Cottage Grove. Rebecca, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share my experience of going back to college in my 40s. I never have a college degree. I dropped out of college when I was in my 20s, and I always regretted it, and I always thought, I can do that, I could do that, and I never went back. I finally went back for a healthcare degree, which is a pretty demanding field, and I really had to learn how to study. And I just wanted to share how I did it. I actually graduated 4.0 top of my class, and I got a 97 on my boards. Yeah. And this is how I studied. So as an adult, you care more, right? Because you pay for your schooling out of your own pocket. So I wanted to study as much as I could, but I wanted it to be efficient. So I would tape all of my lectures on my phone and take notes in class, and then I would get home and I would rewrite my notes in outline form, and then I would listen to the lecture the next day on my way to school. And then in the end of the week on a Saturday, I would rewrite my notes again, but this time I would photocopy diagrams and color them in and label them. And then when I went to study, all my notes were perfection. So if I had to study, I had it all written two or three times already. And I kind of knew it all already, but I also made flashcards on my phone.
Wow.
Which now you can do in digital. So when I was sitting in waiting rooms, I would do flashcards. I was always quizzing myself. I would have people look at my flashcards and quiz me.
Nice.
I just did everything I could.
Rebecca, congratulations on going back, getting that degree, doing so well. I hear so much from your book there, Regan, spacing it out. She did that, you know, yep, over the course of time with the same material. Go where you want with it, because she gave us a lot to work with.
Oh, and you know, I mean, Rebecca, that's almost a case study in some of the best things to do. And I just wanted to highlight a couple of different things in there. The biggest thing I hope everybody listening saw or heard is Rebecca did a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. It's not just flashcards. It's not just one thing or the other. The real bottom line with studying is the more you do with the material, the better you're going to learn it. The deeper you process it, the better you're going to remember it. And I have to underline one big thing in what you said, Rebecca, because it's a whole chapter in the book, and that's note-taking. Note-taking is one of the most underutilized study techniques. It is an actual study technique. It's not just capturing information. And your example of writing and rewriting and playing with your notes, that's just such a neat thing to keep in mind, because when we take notes, we are processing the material more, and you doing that multiple times helped you process it more. And wow, yeah, no wonder there was a 97 there. So good job.
Rebecca, thanks again for calling. We're talking to Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story in your own life of effective studying or less effective studying, something that you thought might work but didn't, or you were pretty sure wasn't going to work and were proven right along the way. Or if you're a teacher, if you teach people stuff, love to hear what you see in your students. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Regan Gurung, psychology professor at Oregon State University, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. You can join in with your study habits, how they worked or let you down. Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Go back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Milwaukee. Bill, hi.
Hello, everybody. I taught writing English for MPS for years. In fact, I founded the creative writing department at the High School of the Arts. I stayed in touch with many of my kids at the beginning, and the main reason they were able to succeed in college was that they were able to write. I spoke to the superintendent that making reading the top priority is wrong, because reading is passive. Writing is active. We work with journals. We wrote every day. In fact, when the head of the English department did
I think I got you, Bill. Got some background noise there. But Regan, the value, I mean, especially with a subject like English, the value of writing and journaling and just constantly doing it.
And I think that nicely underlines the note-taking point, because when you're writing, right, you're really having your brain do stuff with the material. And, you know, definitely in creative writing courses and in English courses, but I think writing in any format is getting you to do things with the material. That's why, you know, whether it's writing an essay or writing notes in class, instead of just writing down what's on a slide, you know, push yourself to write about what you're hearing, write about what you're reading. And even if you don't have a writing assignment in the class, you writing and pulling thoughts together and material together is having you do stuff with that material that, again, helps you hang on to it more and brings out more. You know, and that's why I think I have to throw in this, you know, in higher ed right now, there's all this, you know, a lot of us are concerned about ChatGPT and AI and writing. And it's almost like as good as ChatGPT is, the soul in the machine isn't there. And when we write, you know, there's stuff that's the emergent properties of our different thought processes are coming together in a way that where AI isn't there yet, you know, which is why any writing in class, any writing to process the material is going to help you learn better.
Bill, thanks a lot for calling in. Diane joins us now in Elkhorn. Diane, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I had a daughter that was dyslexic. She was a very oral learner, and when she needed to learn something, I would sing it. I would put it in a song and she could learn it. I would sing her spelling words, I would sing her history facts, and now she works with a girl that has autism, and when she needs her to get dressed, she puts it in a song, and she has time to put on deodorant, and the girl sings, no stinky bits, no stinky bits. Anything I needed a child to do, if they wouldn't do it any other way, I would sing it, and oftentimes they would do it.
Diane, thanks a lot for the call. Whether it's singing or something else, Regan, I think creatively engaging with our material seems to be something that is going to help us.
Right, and beyond creatively engaging, what you see here is you're using more than one modality. So there's a more general term we call this dual coding. Whenever we're trying to remember something, if you can dual code it, where it's not just a word, but it's a word and music, or it's a word and a picture. To remember complex things, and in some cases, even things, you know, routines that you want to remember, if you can link something with either music or an imagery, it makes remembering certain things easier. And I think that's what we had here, was that it was almost a mnemonic device where that repetition yoked or tied to the melody helped, you know, recollection of it.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Regan Gurung, co-author of the new book, Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. Back to your calls now. Maddie is on the line in Milwaukee. Maddie, hello.
Afternoon. How are you guys? Great topic.
Thanks. What experience do you want to share with us, Maddie?
Well, back to Rebecca, and I'm assuming it was nursing school. I also went back to school after having other degrees in my 40s, and at MATC in Milwaukee, I found an amazing instructor. Unfortunately, she's passed away, but she taught a learning strategies course that really opened up my eyes and made me realize what my strong suits were and how to really hold on to what I was trying to learn. And in nursing school, there's a lot of heavy material.
I bet.
And this learning strategies between auditory, tactile, which writing your notes, auditory by recording the lectures and re-listening to them, and then verbally saying things out loud as well. So I love what Regan is teaching, and I think the professors and the teachers out there have seen students struggle, and they're finding ways to give a lending hand any possible way they can, because our future is about education and people having passion in their work. And when you're struggling with test anxiety and so forth, that's when you start having people drop out of school.
So. Maddie, thanks so much for sharing that with us. Regan, the idea of a class in how to learn, I'm assuming you're on board with this idea.
Oh, absolutely. I actually teach a course in the science of teaching and learning where we go into it. And, you know, honestly, it's not even just the class. I think far too often, many of us, especially in college and universities, assume that our students know how to do this. And it's not that easy. There is science that shows you the right ways, but it's not necessarily what you would normally think of as being the right ways. And I think, I'm a big proponent of it, no matter what class you're teaching, especially if it's a first year class or a second year class, take time out of class to talk about study strategies, to talk about the best way to go. Because both Maddie and Rebecca alluded to, you know, many medical terms and a lot of terms to memorize. That can be stressful, but the good news is a lot of these strategies, retrieval practice and note-taking and spacing, those are exceedingly good, especially if you have medical terms or a lot of content to memorize. So right on board with that, we need to be talking about this more and not assuming that people know how to do it.
Thanks a lot for that call, Maddie. Regan, I want to talk about big picture strategy. In one of your chapters, you talk about scheduling, having our plan of how and when we're going to fit these different study methods into our actual lives. Can you tell us, give us an overview of that?
Sure. I think one of the thinking about thinking and planning all falls into the jargony term metacognition. But metacognition, or really planning out your studying, is really the first critical step to establishing a good study pattern. And I think this becomes even more important when you factor in that a person may have 2, 3, 4, 5 classes and work and all of these different things to do. So when you plan out or schedule out when you're going to study, that makes it more likely that it gets done, because then you can visually note what all you have to get done and where. It's also important to actually walk the walk of some of these key practices. I mean, I may say repeatedly testing yourself is good, and I will say spacing it out is good, but it's very hard to remember to space things out and remember to repeatedly test yourself when you've got 5 classes and work. So starting with scheduling, and you find the way you want to do it. I'm old school. I love paper. You can use, you know, an app, but have a schedule of when you're going to do what, and that right there takes out some cognitive load, mental load, and it makes it easier to focus on what you have to do and when.
Regan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Regan Gurung, professor of psychology at Oregon State University, co-author of the book Study Like a Champ, the psychology-based guide to grade A study habits. If you have a lesson learned you'd like to share, you can still do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, explore the worlds of pop culture with the author of the book Nerd, Adventures in Fandom from This Universe to the Multiverse. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.